And that's the kicky music that means it is time again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. On this week's show, it's a slow time for pop culture as summer blockbusters and summer television have slowed down and the autumnal onslaught hasn't begun. So we'll pause for a couple of seasonal conversations. In honor of bringing an end to the dog days of summer, we'll talk about, that's right, pop culture dogs. And then we'll turn our attention to classic movies we love and perhaps recommend a few for you to check out in these slow moments before the fall begins in earnest. And as always, we'll close with what's making us happy this week. Before we get started, let's go around the table. Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am a writer and editor with NPR Music.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I edit movies coverage, mostly for the website.
And Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
Well, I'm awfully glad to see all of you back here. As noted, summer is coming to an end. It must happen every year. And I was reading today about when the dog days of summer are typically understood to take place. It's those hottest days up until perhaps the beginning of September, early September. So they are closing down. And so it's dog time. Here at Pop Culture Happy Hour. Now, we're not talking about dogs like, for example, the newsroom. Just kidding.
Oh, yes.
I did it once. Come on.
Buzzing.
We're not talking about that kind of dogs. We're talking about literal, actual pop culture dogs. Stephen, tell me about a pop culture dog of your acquaintance.
My choice is the origin of a sort of pop culture flop, but in its original form, it is awesome. Mm-hmm. And that choice is The Family Dog.
Oh, sure. Hmm.
So The Family Dog, in its ultimate sitcom form, lasted 11 episodes. Mm-hmm. And it had the voices of, like, Martin Mull and, you know, and people like that. In its original form, the pilot for The Family Dog is completely delightful and, like the show itself, totally out of print. But my family had a presumably Betamax copy of it that I absolutely wore into the ground. And I went back on YouTube and found at least there was like an 8-minute chunk of it, uh-huh, of the pilot on, uh-huh, on YouTube. It originally aired on, do you remember Amazing Stories?
Oh, yeah.
Sure.
Hmm.
So it originally aired as like a special episode of Amazing Stories. And my parents and I just roared with laughter the whole time. And I went back and rewatched this chunk of it, at which point I discovered, written and directed by Brad Bird.
Oh.
Brad Bird. This is the guy who, you know, brought you the Iron Giant.
The Iron Giant. The Incredibles. Yeah. Ratatouille.
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. So, you know, became like an Oscar-winning mega Pixar superstar director.
Right.
Also directed Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol,
mm-hmm,
his first live-action
movie, which I think
is a load of fun. So it has a lot of Brad Bird's sort of signatures. It's definitely Chuck Jones influenced, where it does a lot with kind of madcap music, a lot with facial expressions. It's got that animation style where motion is part of the storytelling process,
mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
and it's really wonderfully great fun. But it's really interesting when you compare the pilot to the actual show. A lot of the voice cast has turned over, and in its original form, you get Annie Potts as the sort of embittered mom of the family, and the dad and lots of the male voices is played by Stan Freeberg.
Classic radio comedy man,
ad man. Mm-hmm. You know, the voice behind all of like the funniest radio, mm-hmm, commercials, mm-hmm, ever, and just a really spectacularly great voice actor. Now in the sitcom that springs up 6 years later, you have Martin Mull, mm-hmm, playing that. Nothing against Martin Mull, mm-hmm, but I feel like, you know, it's if you compare the two, there's kind of a drop off in every way, and it's sort of sad because I remember, you know, when the original aired in 1987, I would have been 14 or 15, thinking this is the new frontier and amazing, and it turned out not to be The Family Dog, but The Simpsons that would do that. But I remember having that initial blush of being excited. So the Family Dog itself is there's my dog. It's just a little sort of put upon little dog who's inadvertently getting up to no good.
Wonderful.
Hmm. I'm curious, did we all choose cartoon dogs, or did we mix it up?
No, I think there's a combination of dogs. I'll get to my taxonomy of dogs.
Yeah, I wanted to go directly to the taxonomy of dogs,
okay,
rather than recommending anything in particular. Because I came, you know, I wrote down this gigantic list, and then I sort of started sorting them into categories and looking at their attributes and stuff like that. And I think Linda set this question up really well with her jokes about what a dog. You know, the word has so many different connotations in just our language, in the language of popular culture, that I think it's really fascinating that on the one hand, we've got these symbols of loyalty and fidelity and bravery, and then it's also a synonym for something that's completely rotten, right?
So did you have a taxonomy of particular dogs in mind, or?
Well, there are the loyal dogs,
right?
the faithful dogs, the Snoopies and the Old Yellers and the whoever else's. But then you've got funny dogs, and funny dogs come in an interesting variety.
Mm-hmm.
They're tiny, or they're gigantic.
That's true.
Right? But they're almost never middle-sized.
That's true.
Mm. You're thinking of your Clifford the Big Red Dogs and your Marmadukes and then your Beverly
Beethovens.
Hills Chihuahuas and your Beethovens.
Sure.
And your Bruisers.
Right. And your Hooch.
Hooch.
And your Hooch.
Right?
Yeah.
from Turner and Hooch.
You don't have a lot of your mid-sized, your
mid-sized dog. You got your Benji.
Your Lassie.
And your Benji and your Lassie.
Benji's a small dog, though.
Yeah, he's not tiny, though. He's not a purse dog. He's not a dog that's a cat.
True, it's not that.
Like Eddie and Uggie.
But he's also not a funny dog. He's a brave dog.
He's a brave dog. He's a loyal dog.
All right, so you got funny dogs, you got brave dogs.
Yeah but see, your point about loyalty, a lot of people will say that's what a dog is. That's the essential doggishness of a dog, is loyalty. That's not what makes me love dogs, because I think if you are valuing loyalty over everything else, that says something about you. That kind of says that there's a certain neediness that is at your essential core. Like, why is that the thing? Why is that the metric? For me, the thing that I love about dogs is that they are so blissfully uncomplicated. Here is a word you will never hear ascribed to a dog: inscrutable. Because the dog is the most scrutable.
They are so very scrutable. That's
true. You can scrute them coming a mile away. So that's why, for example, you see a sort of Skinner box process happening in Doug from Up.
My name is Doug. I have just met you, and I love you. My master made me this collar. He is a good and smart master, and he made me this collar so that I may talk. Squirrel!
There is no guile in a dog.
And there's a mid-sized dog.
Right. Mm-hmm. There's also Bandit from a comic called We Three, which is by Grant Morrison and Frank Quitely. It's the story of the military taking a dog, a cat, and a bunny and putting them in military's armor with all kinds of weapons in it. It sounds like a fun romp, right?
Sure.
It is harrowing. It is brutal, and it is ultimately very, very sad, but it plays on that same thing, that same uncomprehending simplicity of the dog.
Mm-hmm.
There's also a manga called Stargazing Dog, which has this very happy little cover of a little Akita pup smiling out at you.
You have talked about this one on the show before.
I have written about this on the blog, yes, and then you see it and the dog dies, and it's just like, why did the dog always die?
Yeah.
Stop killing the dogs, people.
Yeah.
It's funny how that happens. It's dogs and moms. If you're talking about animation in particular, the body count of mothers in animation and dogs in dramas.
Right.
Yeah, it's true. Because when I was thinking about the taxonomy of dogs, I was thinking about it a little bit differently than Trey. I was thinking you sort of have your big, sloppy, all-over-the-place dog, your Odie. But your Marmaduke, your Beethoven, your Hooch, your Cujo.
Pretty sloppy.
Cujo's totally on my list.
I was going to say, Stephen Thompson.
yep.
As opposed to your natty dog. You have your Eddie, your Uggie, your Bruiser,
Uggie, your Aster.
Your Beverly Hills Chihuahua, your Trey Grant.
Yep.
That's fair.
And then you have sort of your working, no-nonsense dog, your Lassie, your Rin Tin Tin, your
Glenn Weldon.
Your Glenn Weldon.
Okay.
Right? I am the only one who gets to not be a dog. But I want to ask a trivia question, though.
Mm-hmm.
I want to ask a trivia question. Three live-action dog movies have grossed over $100 million.
Turner and Hooch is one, isn't it?
No,
it didn't make that much.
$100 million live-action dog movies.
Beethoven.
Anyone?
Beethoven.
Well, does the artist count?
No. About or really starring dogs. They are Scooby-Doo. That is number one. Scooby-Doo.
Oh, right. There is a live-action Scooby-Doo.
The live-action Scooby-Doo.
Although the dog is not live-action.
It's a dog.
It's a live action.
The movie's called Scooby-Doo, and Scooby-Doo is the dog.
Scooby-Doo.
Was Benji?
No.
Of the Benji movies?
No. Marley and Me.
Ugh.
And the live-action 101 Dalmatians. But the one that I would mention, if I could only mention one pop culture presentation of dogs, I think I would have to go with Best in Show.
Oh, yeah.
Christopher Guest mockumentary about all of the people who are in a dog show. If I start naming the cast, it's just going to go completely insane.
All of them. But, all of the Christopher
all of
Guest
them.
People.
It's the Christopher Guest
your Balaban
repertory or, company. Or. And that movie, to me, it has not necessarily become quite as widely quoted as Guffman, for example, or certainly Spinal Tap. But Best in Show, to me, has a very uncomfortable, close and convincing relationship with Neurosis.
Yeah, yeah.
That I think is the couple where Parker Posey is the wife and they raise kind of the neurotic, what, greyhounds or something like that?
Weimaraner, right?
Weimaraner, yes. I knew it was a neurotic skinny dog. they raise sort of these neurotic bony dogs, and I find that so funny.
What do you see in front of me? What do you see in front of me? You see a big blue ribbon. It's right here in front of you. You want it? You come and you grab it. You get it.
She's not
get
listening to you. She's nervous. She's freaking
well,
out.
Well, get the busy bee. You want your busy bee? Get your busy
you
bee.
You get the busy bee. I need to trim her whiskers.
And well, they sort of imprint their own horrible relationship onto the dog.
Right. Yeah. It is a movie that I really, really love. I am less attracted to the sort of tragedy dogs, the Where the Red Fern Grows,
yeah.
The Old Yeller,
yeah, right.
You know, and then the dog has to eat it.
Yeah. So, no,
it's this mindset in children's literature, like, well, you got to learn about death.
Right.
Like, screw that.
Exactly.
You don't have to learn about death.
Exactly. Although the truth of the matter is all of these dogs are great dogs and are lovable dogs, mm-hmm. and the people in the stories love them very much. They're all inferior to the dogs that I've had, of course. Specifically the wonderful Cinnamon, who was a smallish dog.
Here we go.
And then the amazing Sandy, who was a larger dog.
I've met Sandy, right? Yeah. Sandy was a good dog.
Yeah, Sandy was a very, very good dog. So I just want to say that I love these dogs in the pop culture, but I don't want my dogs who are in heaven now.
Because
all dogs.
Right,
all
exactly.
Dogs go to heaven.
Thank you. To think that I love them any less.
All right, Stephen Thompson, can you name the three great dogs that The Simpsons has brought us?
Well, Santa's Little Helper.
You got the one.
The helper dog, Laddie.
Okay, well, four great dogs.
I'm trying to think of all the dogs, that have, the various hounds that Mr. Burns has unleashed.
There's 5 to 10 great dogs. All right, here's what I'm talking about. I'm talking about Santa's Little Helper, Poochie,
oh,
who
God,
has
course,
become a symbol.
How could you miss Poochie? How could you miss Poochie?
I was thinking of actual dogs and not
He's become
dogs.
A symbol for corporate interference in creative endeavors. He's just bigger than
well,
me.
And also for self-centeredness.
Absolutely.
In the sense that the thing that I hear the most is, where's Poochie? Where's Poochie?
And this one's tougher because he only had a cameo appearance, but looms large, the shifty-eyed dog. Do you remember
yes.
the shifty-eyed dog?
Yes.
He just looks left and right because he looks creepy. I have to throw out three quick shout-outs, as the kids used to say, to Crypto the Super Dog.
Mm-hmm.
It is a dog that flies with a cape. And if I have to explain why that's awesome, you and I could not be even casual friends. He is beaten, however, in my book, by a dog that appeared 3 months after Crypto. In March 1955, Crypto appeared. In June 1955, Ace the Bat Hound appeared.
Wow.
Ace the Bat Hound is a German Shepherd that
doesn't even need a cowl.
He does. That's the awesome part, Stephen Thompson. Bruce Wayne adopts a German Shepherd. It's got a very distinctive star-shaped pattern on its forehead. Therefore, when he goes out to fight crime, he puts a mask on. It is a German Shepherd in a mask. But finally, I have to say that in 1964, a character appeared who has cast a long shadow into history, because when in this world, the headlines read, "Of those whose hearts are filled with greed."
Oh, gosh.
"Who rob and steal from those in need." To write that wrong, with blinding speed comes
Robin Hood dog.
Underdog. Now, the show itself is pretty awesome. It's funny. Some great vocal work by the great Wally Cox. But it also ushered in an entire wave of superhero parody. It was Underdog who led the way.
I read this in a very good book recently.
Yes, thank you. Underdog came first. Then there was Adamant, Super Chicken, Mighty Heroes, Captain Nice, Mr. Terrific. If it wasn't for Underdog, the Batman television show, like it or love it, I happen to love it, probably couldn't have gotten off the ground. Because
you had me at Super Chicken.
Yes, right. He made everything possible. Shout has released a 10-disc DVD set of the entire Underdog series.
I had already owned it.
I was going to say, I either have that or I gave it to someone.
It's awesome.
And I will say, we have talked mostly about movie dogs, but there are TV dogs. Obviously,
sure.
There is Eddie, who
Eddie
we've mentioned.
On Frasier, yeah.
And I will say one of the best used pop culture dogs on television was actually a dog named Vincent, who was on Lost, who played a very major role in the opening and closing imagery of that show.
And who managed to survive, even as many of the humans fell
really,
by the wayside.
Who really became a symbol of sort of resilience. And the interesting thing is we've talked about how a lot of times they kill the dog just to make a point, right?
Right.
On a show where everybody could, you know, bite it at any time, and many people eventually did. Spoiler alert, the dog lives.
Oh, forget it. I'm not bothering to watch that now.
So no matter what happens to the humans and whatever, Vincent is eternal. And Vincent is very comforting in that show. And I would have to spoil it more to explain that. But Vincent plays a major role in sort of being comforting, which I find that dogs in real life have that role.
Unless, of course, they are Buck from Married with Children, who is judgmental.
Right.
Judgy dog.
He is judgy dog.
I like it when every once in a while you actually have, like, a bad dog in these things. Because dogs really are, they tend to be sort of idealized.
But you don't mean, like, a bad dog in the sort of, like, he got into the slippers.
I don't mean Cujo. You know, I don't mean killer dog. You're sloppy, the dog that's always licking itself. You know, I mean, that's part of why I love, I mean, among the many billions of things I love about The Simpsons is that Santa's Little Helper is sort of a mess, you know, sort of a dis. Mm-hmm. He's a Simpson.
Have we gone this long without talking about Rin Tin Tin?
We have.
Well, I mean, we haven't talked much about Rin Tin Tin, Lassie, Benji, a lot of your proto.
Talking about it, let us just refer you to Susan Orlean's book about Rin Tin Tin, which is an amazing bit of storytelling, as, you know, as she tends to do. But she really dug into this dog's history, and it's an extraordinary history. And of course, it's many more than one dog over the years.
Right.
But talk about your famous TV dogs, that's one.
Yeah, it is.
And I kind of wanted to make sure we also talk about not just comic dogs and not just hero dogs, but I want to talk about, it gets back to what I said right at the beginning about how it can have a really negative connotation. I mean, we talk about the black dog of depression. Right?
Uh-huh.
And then there's...
Do we?
We do.
You do.
Never talked about the black dog.
It's a real thing. And then there's the black dog that is, in sort of European culture, thought of as a harbinger of death. There's the blue dog in Louisiana, who's a version of the loup-garou.
Aren't they like a conservative Democrat?
Yeah, that's what I thought.
No. That's an expression. But the blue dog is a guy named Georges Rodrigue, I think is how he pronounces it. He's from New Iberia, Louisiana, and he paints these sort of iconic paintings, all of which contain a blue dog. And it's about melancholy, and it's about the supernatural, and it's about the spirit world. And then there's the guardian dogs, right? Your Anubis and your Cerberus and all of that. Mm-hmm.
Those things in Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
Yes.
And the foo dogs that guard the temples in China, and the red dog of the Aztecs who leads you to the underworld.
Well, there's a very close relationship between the cultural understanding of dogs and the cultural understanding of wolves. And so wherever you have sort of an understanding of wolves as sort of both faithful pack animal and also possibly predator, you have sort of that same ambiguity, I think, in parts of the way that we relate to dogs. Whereas culturally they do, in pop culture, I think they do tend to show up either in the beloved family member way or in the comic relief kind of way.
Mm-hmm.
I do love me some Uggie. I enjoy Uggie. Well, now, I want to make clear, sometimes people come to us after the show, to our Facebook page, which, by the way, is at facebook.com/PCHH, and they say, how could you leave out my favorite dog? How could you get all the way through this segment and you did not mention, let's say, Lou Grant, for example, who came up when we didn't talk about him during spinoff discussion last week, but it is not our intention to catalog every pop culture dog. We leave that to you. Come and see us on Facebook. Come and see us at the blog at npr.org/PCHH. And tell us all about, you know, your favorite pop culture dog. What did we forget?
We forgot Gromit.
Yes, we forgot Gromit. So, you know, woof woof, come and hang out and tell us exactly what dogs we forgot. And that brings us to the end of dogs. How do you guys feel about that? The end of dogs. Still a cat person.
Yeah.
See, the last time I made a sweeping generalization in front of Linda Holmes and I said something like, women are cats, men are dogs, I got a fair amount of stuff for that. But I spent 2 years in a writing program and I maintain to this day, poets are cats, fiction writers are dogs.
I don't know. My cats mostly spend most of their time vomiting everywhere. Yeah. Is that a thing?
I am not. I simply feel that I am more a dog than a cat. And I feel that if you think that ladies are cats, I'm not that like standoffish, chilly kind of thing. You know me. I'm more the jump up on you and come play with me.
I just mostly leave hair everywhere, but that doesn't really...
At any rate, so this is the end of the dog days of summer, and the other thing we were thinking about as summer comes to an end is that this is a time when a lot of the movies that are coming out are not appealing to us that much, and they're kind of holding the fall movies for a couple more weeks, and the summer movies are kind of over, and you're sort of in this in-between period. So we thought we would talk about classic movies, and we're going to try to talk about some that we have not talked about all the time in the past. We all have our classics to which we return over and over. We're going to try to find some new ground. So I'm going to go the other direction. Glenn Weldon, talk to me about a classic movie.
Okay. Well, I was looking for something that, you know, we haven't talked about a lot, that other people haven't talked about a lot. Mm-hmm. You know, I think one of the original sample names for this segment was going to be Beyond Casablanca. Mm-hmm. Like, just let everybody know it's Casablanca. Let's not talk Casablanca anymore.
Sure.
Citizen Kane, exactly the same thing. But I do love Orson Welles. I love The Third Man, which he didn't write or direct, but, well, he had a cameo appearance in, and he was excellent in. I love The Lady from Shanghai, which is another Orson Welles film. I love Touch of Evil very much. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, because what those films share is a sort of idiosyncratic approach. They don't look and feel like other films of the time, and they don't look like feel like other films today. So for that, I kind of continued that same thread and went with the 1955 film The Night of the Hunter. Have we all seen this film?
I don't think so.
Robert Mitchum, Shelley Winters, Lillian Gish. Robert Mitchum stars as an evil, murderous preacher who stalks this family, these two little kids especially, because he's hoping that they will lead him to some stolen money. It was directed by Charles Laughton, the actor who played Captain Bligh and The Hunchback of Notre Dame. This is a beautiful-looking film, and it's got a weird alchemy. It's got your Southern Gothic melodrama of the plot layered with the approach, the cinematography, is pure German expressionism.
Yep.
So
yep.
Weird shadows and weird shots. And it's got a nice little dose at the very end there of crazy pants.
I have this on Blu-ray, and I haven't watched it yet because I'm almost afraid to watch it alone. It's supposed to be that scary.
I don't think, when I see this film in a movie theater, and I've seen it several times in a movie theater, it gets laughs because there is nothing subtle about this film. It is all over the top. It's like Charles Laughton told his actors, go big or go home, and nobody went home. There's a scene where the kids are escaping down the river in a boat, and the perspective of the shot is as if they're escaping from a spider web. It's like, okay, we get it. I see what you're doing there. There's a scene where he's chasing the kids, and he's got this feral rage. Robert Mitchum has this feral rage, and he starts stumbling toward them like Frankenstein. And that scene always gets a laugh in the moment, but if you think about it later, that's kind of nightmarish. There's something else going on, this feeling that somebody's coming after you really slowly. So for my money, it's the best looking American film of all time. But the thing that a lot of people remember about this film is not the look, but the sound. Specifically, as Robert Mitchum is hunting these kids across the South, he sings this hymn.
Mm-hmm.
And this hymn, especially with his voice, is creepy as all get out.
Leaning, safe and secure from all alarms. Leaning.
So that's a scene where we see the kids all nestled in their bed. They found some safety, but then they hear, after they've been hearing this, they hear that song, they look out their front window, and they see him in their front yard. Now, Lillian Gish, their protector, is sitting on the porch in the shadows with a shotgun, defending the kids. And later on in that scene, his sort of sinister version of that hymn mixes with her. She starts singing a very sort of churchy version of the same hymn, and their voices blend. And it's just a fantastic, deeply, deeply weird film that I love.
Wonderful.
Nice.
I don't know. That sounds kind of maybe too scary for me.
No, it's great.
Trey Graham.
Well, when you talk about films that are not like anything else of their time, my thoughts go immediately to one that was on my list, which is Barry Lyndon. It's a Kubrick film based on the Thackeray novel. It is meticulously observed, glacially paced, gorgeously shot. It's a gigantic costume drama. It's about an opportunistic Irishman in the 18th century. Ryan O'Neill and Marissa Berenson is the female lead. Check it out. It is endless, but it is well worth watching.
The words glacially paced and endless aren't making me run to the...
No, it is just so stylish that it's worth it.
Okay.
My next picks are not old enough yet to be considered classics,
but I think they're
instant classics.
I think that's all right.
And I'm thinking of the unintentional haute couture trilogy that is Bill Cunningham, New York, the September issue, and The Devil Wears Prada.
Sure.
I love all three of those as a sort of case study.
Mm-hmm.
Funny Girl, because it's a sturdy story, and because Omar Sharif. Similarly, The Sting, because A, the music is great, B, the story is fantastic, and Robert Redford plus Paul Newman.
I enjoy The Sting. It's a good movie.
The Sting is a terrific movie. I haven't seen it in years, but
if you want to see weird costume drama, Orlando, which was of Tilda Swinton's earlier films.
So. Stephen Thompson.
Now, I picked a movie from 1944 called The Uninvited.
This is the voice of the uninvited.
I had originally thought, that's probably too well known, because we were kind of talking about picking, you know, unearthing some obscurities. Then I poked around. It is not on DVD. Hmm. The only copy of it that I have is on VHS, and it has never been released on DVD. It stars Ray Milland and Ruth Hussey as a brother and sister who, as brothers and sisters do, decide to buy a house together. In a coastal town in England, they buy this gigantic house that has been sitting on the market for years and years and years. And gosh, you know, they get a really great deal on it.
You see where
it's going. I mean, it's a haunted house drama. Kind of billed as a horror movie almost, kind of in the spirit of Night of the Hunter. It is a fantastically entertaining and subtle movie. It is a horror movie with not the slightest foray into gore or special effects or anything. It's a triumph of sort of sound editing and pacing for dramatic effect. And I picked it in part to beg whatever powers that be are out there in the world to put the freaking thing out on DVD. Uh-huh. I think Leonard Part 6 is on DVD. You know? Every movie ever is on DVD. But The Uninvited from 1944 is not. And it is a terrific movie.
Wonderful. Well, on this show in the past, I am quite sure that I have talked about Singing in the Rain. Everybody who knows me well knows that I have a longstanding Gene Kelly thing. And in fact, this past week would have been Gene Kelly's 100th birthday. So there's been some talk about him. Many of you have probably seen Singing in the Rain. It does kick around. Some of you will have seen perhaps An American in Paris with the very long ballet at the end, which is actually, believe it or not, one of my least favorites of his movies. But the one I'm going to recommend that you look a little harder for is On the Town, which stars, it's one of two where he was sailors with Frank Sinatra. And they were in Anchors Away together, which is cute, is also fun, but I prefer On the Town. On the Town is sort of, to me, when I was growing up as a sort of burgeoning fan of musicals, I thought of there being like the city musical and the country musical. You basically had your Oklahoma and Seven Brides for Seven Brothers and all that stuff on one hand, and then you had your kind of city musical, your West Side Story and stuff like that. And On the Town to me is sort of the perfect upbeat city musical. This is the one that opens with the New York, New York, wonderful town, the Bronx is up and the battery's down. And it stars Gene Kelly and Frank Sinatra and a guy named Jules Munchen, who was their third. And then the women are Vera Ellen is Gene Kelly's girl. Betty Garrett, who was wonderful, is Frank Sinatra's girl. And then Ann Miller.
Ann Miller.
And if you have never seen a movie with Ann Miller at the height of her Ann Millerness dancing, you really should, because she was wonderful and sort of dirty in this very understated, completely implied way. She was just body in a completely organic way. So that is a terrific one, and I absolutely recommend it. It has some great New York stuff, some of which is actually shot in New York, some of which you can see the people gawking at the filming, which is sort of the kind of thing that they might fix now, but at the time you can see them all crowded, people all crowded around watching them film, which is sort of funny. And then I also wanted to mention that many of you have perhaps seen Psycho.
Sure.
But recently I have seen in theaters both Rear Window.
Oh, that's such a great movie.
And Dial M for Murder. And both of those I enjoyed very, very much. And particularly, I think Rear Window is maybe a little bit more currently circulating.
Sure.
What I love about Rear Window is the tension of it because it's so confined and because the setting is so simple. But Dial M for Murder is a little bit more convoluted as it sort of goes on. But again, it has a wonderful plot that revolves around all this stuff about where is this key at this moment versus where this key is at that moment. And it's just one of those things where pieces go clickety-clickety-click and fall into place in this incredibly satisfying way. And I so strongly recommend that you seek that movie out, because it's so easy to say Hitchcock and people think like, oh, like Psycho, like whatever. See one of these more understated, more logic-driven, intricately plotted suspense films.
Could not agree with you more. And I mean, several of the movies that you mentioned are like big classic movies, quote-unquote, everyone has heard of them. But you know what? New fans are born all
absolutely,
the time.
Absolutely, absolutely.
And there are, I'm willing to wager that there are a whole lot of people listening to this show who have not seen Rear Window. They're probably more familiar with it from parodies on The Simpsons than they are. That movie is not only fantastically suspenseful, but funny.
Yeah. It also has Grace Kelly in this kind of amazing Grace Kelly performance. If you've only seen Grace Kelly sort of in pictures or in news footage or whatever, you got to actually see her act, and particularly in this movie, she's so enchanting that you completely understand how she became who she was. Mm-hmm. So I really recommend that you seek both of those movies out because they're wonderful. And then my last shout out would be to the two legal movies that I loved as a young person that perhaps forecast the interest in law that I would have later, one of which is Inherit the Wind.
Oh, mm-hmm. I was assuming you were going to say 12 Angry Men.
That's the other one. Inherit the Wind and 12 Angry Men, both sort of trial court related thundering lawyer or surrogate lawyer movies, and both well worth seeing. The 12 Angry Men that stars Henry Fonda has a great cast, Jack Warden and Jack Klugman and a little bit of everybody.
All the Jacks.
Can't go wrong with Klugman.
Yeah. And then Inherit the Wind has Spencer Tracy and actually has a little Gene Kelly in it, and that's a good one too. All right. Well, that brings us to the end of our classic movies, and you should by all means see
all of them out. We did not cover all the classic
movies. It's not a catalog of all classic movies. But we will make sure to list the ones that we thought of on the on the Facebook page or the blog, and so you'll be able to find the ones that we brought up. And that brings us, of course, to our final segment, which is what is making us happy this week. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
A couple things. Last week I put out a call for tell me if this book, this fantasy novel, has already been written, and many people responded by saying, yes, that book has already been written.
Not quite, though. Well, nobody quite.
So
I think the field's still open.
I want to thank everybody who suggested that I read Sir Apropos of Nothing by Peter David, Ender's Game by Orson Scott Card, a book I have never read nor will ever read because, seriously, screw that guy, a video game called Heavenly Sword, and a book called Mistborn, The Final Empire by the improbably named Brandon Sanderson.
Awesome.
Manfringenmanson. Also, all those people who said that my Sopranos out of water is Lilyhammer, basically, thanks for playing. I'm aware of its work, but it doesn't scratch the itch that I was talking about. But the main thing I want to talk about this week is if you have been avoiding the Richard Linklater film Bernie, because for whatever reason, you are not picking up what Jack Black has been putting down forever, you should know two things about this film. A, the trailer is lying to you. The trailer suggests that he spends a lot of screen time with Shirley MacLaine and Matthew McConaughey. Matthew McConaughey has maybe 10 lines in this film and spends less than 4 minutes on screen.
Hmm.
Shirley MacLaine is there a lot, but she doesn't do much. This is Jack Black's film. So if you have an anti-Jack Black thing, you should know that. The second thing you should know is that Jack Black is great in this. The film is pretty broad. It's about a guy who is beloved by this small town in Texas who kills the woman that he's shacked up with, but everybody hated her and loves him.
Based on a true story.
The film is pretty broad. They bring the characters of the town in, so it's pretty sort of almost Raising Arizona-esque, but his performance is very small and very specific and really a lot of fun. So check it out. Bernie.
I adored that movie. I saw it at South by Southwest, and what I said about it at the time was, Matthew McConaughey is not on screen much, but I think he's dynamite in it. And this is essentially three people, Linklater, Jack Black, and Matthew McConaughey, all of whom I can go either way.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So when I see those three names, I think, let's see. I loved it. I thought it was awesome. You will know what I'm talking about. The description of Texas and the regions of Texas was one of the fun, and you can imagine the laugh that got in Austin. So I absolutely, completely agree with that. You can find it. It's streaming in various places for rent, or you can rent it or find it on demand or whatever. Absolutely loved Bernie. Totally endorse that recommendation.
Yep.
Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
I think that we did a segment once, or at least we talked about doing a segment, that we were going to call something like Pop Culture Designed for Me, right?
We talked about
something that was just tailored to all of your appetites, right? Well,
I fear where this is going.
Coming to a PBS station near you, or most likely, is a reality competition called Broadway or Bust.
Yes.
It is basically a real-life Glee with a bunch of high school musical theater nerds competing in regional competitions to earn a slot at a New York competition called the Jimmy Awards. 60 kids, 3 episodes, the usual narratives about their home lives and their families and their struggles and their triumphs and all of that. Starts September 9th on a PBS station near you. Check it out.
Here's the thing about Broadway or Bust. They did a presentation about it at TCA. Mm-hmm. I've seen these kids on stage. They are theater nerds through and through, and that's what's so great about them. They are not Glee kids. They would not want to be considered Glee kids. They are Broadway. They are not television.
Yeah.
One of them was asked about sort of like, did you ever think about going on another show like American Idol? And she almost dropped her teeth in horror. She was like, I am an actress. I am a theater actress. So when I sing a song, it is to sing the song and present the position of the character, not to show off like all, ooh. And she was like, she's not like American Idol. But they were very endearing. And I will say that the only slight adjustment I would make to your description is they're not so much regional competitions that lead to this national competition. What they do is they take all the kids who won regional theater awards for stuff they were already doing.
Gotcha.
So it's not like you enter a contest. It's like you receive an award for your theater work in high school. And as a result of receiving that award, you qualify and you go and you participate in this show that they put on in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who do the best while they're putting on that show receive a new award. So they like to talk about it as a couple of award kind of phases, as opposed to like you enter a reality show competition.
So you're not chosen based on your personality disorders.
Hopefully not. They seemed incredibly charming. As I have mentioned to one or two people, one of the kids was a guy who got up and talked about how he had moved to California from, I believe it was Ohio, to escape being bullied.
No.
And I looked at him and I thought, boy, I bet you are. Mm. And I don't mean that mean. I just mean he is the kind of theater kid who can have a very hard time. And he talked about relating a lot to the character of Kurt on Glee.
Yeah.
And I sort of thought, I believe it.
I mean, he has
a very Kurt-like quality.
I got the screeners for this, but I've only watched about 15 minutes in. So.
They seemed very charming. I'm very optimistic. I like that idea. Stephen Thompson, what's making you happy this week?
Well, you know, looking over the schedule of big albums that are coming out this fall, one of the biggest is by a very, very popular group called Mumford & Sons.
Mm-hmm.
I do not like Mumford & Sons.
Right.
I don't like bands that sound like Mumford & Sons, which means I don't like Philip Phillips from American Idol. It means I don't like the Lumineers. For whatever reason, there is a
chemical...
Oh, God.
Can you convey what...
I don't know. You know how I've talked about Clarksonium and Jepsenium, you know, different elements of music, and I like Clarksonium and I like Jepsenium.
Based on, named after Kelly Clarkson and Carly Rae Jepsen.
Thank
I apologize for making the subtext text. But.
Fair enough. I do not like Mumfordium.
Yeah.
There is something about that kind of like,
it's essentially, it's like popified bluegrass folk kind of stuff. Have you ever heard the Avett Brothers?
Yeah, sure.
Well, it's like a third generation photocopy of the Avett Brothers to me. More pop.
Well, it's funny you should mention the Avett Brothers, because what's actually making me happy is that 2 weeks before the new Mumford & Sons record that is going to be a big, 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 big thing, there is a new Avett Brothers record. Now, I once walked up behind Linda Holmes, and she was sitting at her desk at work, and I was just walking up to say hi or whatever, and she was watching on her headphones the Avett Brothers Tiny Desk concert from a few years ago. And when she saw me, she kind of put her headphones down or whatever. And I said at the time, this is like catching you watching porn.
Well, it's more like that because it was like the 50th time I had seen it. So,
well, there's that. Basically, the Avett Brothers are the band that should be. And it's not that they're not very popular. They are very, very popular. But compared to a Mumford & Sons, which is huge, this band is so freaking good. And it's that same kind of, there are elements of that bluegrass and there's pop, but they're also kind of they're kind of punk rooted. So there's energy to it. They aim for profundity and reach it in a way. There's a real voice to their songs. They've got a new record coming out on September 11th called The Carpenter. By the time this episode goes live, it will be streaming on the NPR Music site. Let's just hear a few seconds of the first single from The Carpenter. It's called Live and Die.
You and I are the same. Live and die, we're the same. You rejoice, I complain. But you and I, we're the same. Live and die, we're the same. You and I, we're the same. Hear my voice, know my name. You and I, we're the same.
Avett Brothers, The Carpenter.
That makes sense. That would make you happy. I'm sure that will make me happy.
Terrific
too.
Record.
That will make me a clean kind of happy, I promise. Well, the last couple weeks, I have been telling you every week what my reality show marathon of the weekend was. This weekend, it was Clean House, hosted by Niecy Nash. Uh-huh. And I am going to make the bold statement that Niecy Nash, who unfortunately no longer hosts Clean House, is one of the best hosts that any reality show has ever had. If you do not know Clean House, basically it's one of these shows. They go and they take a family that has a messy, cluttered house, something that I can relate to.
But clutter, not hoarding. Clutter.
Clutter, not hoarding. Absolutely. Okay. Sometimes close to the line, but generally they're all still functioning and happy people. They just need a clutter help. So then they go and they clean out the house and they sell a bunch of stuff at the garage sale, and then they use the money from the garage sale to redecorate parts of the house. And she is always just so funny and warm and nice to people. I was going to say lovely. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to. But Niecy Nash on Clean House was my reality show marathon of this week.
Well, she was also on Dancing with the Stars and was delightful on that.
She was.
People know her from Reno 911.
That's exactly right. For many people, she is from Reno 911. So Niecy Nash, Clean House, that was my reality show marathon, which, as always, means it streams on Netflix. I also read this week, have been reading an advanced copy of a book called Friend Keeping by a writer named Julie Clam, who... It's not going to be out until October, so you have a little while to wait. I'll remind you at the time. But speaking as a person who very, very heavily relies on my friendships as an adult, it is really rare to find somebody who writes funny but also thoughtfully and meaningfully about incredibly important friendships in your adult life, including ones you make as an adult. Because a lot of times when people talk about close friendships they have as adults, they'll be talking about my best friend from when I was 5 and we've stayed friends or whatever. She talks a lot about the importance of the people in your life that you meet as an adult and how important her friends are to her, and also has a lot of respect for kind of flexibility in friendships. One of the things I really have enjoyed about the book is her philosophy of sort of people sometimes come and go a little bit, and sometimes they go and they will eventually come back, and you have to sort of let them drift. And it's a really interesting philosophy of sort of really valuing people but not assigning them to spots and stuff like that. I like it a lot. It's a really terrific book, but I should also say very funny. So that is what's making me happy, Niecy Nash and Julie Clam.
Okay.
And that brings us to the end of our show. You can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen, STEPHEN. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham, Trey with an E, Graham, just like the cracker. You can follow Glenn at G-H Weldon, W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow our producer, Jess Gittner, at Jess Gittner, G-I-T-N-E-R. You can also follow our esteemed producer, emeritus, and music director, Mike Katziff, at Mike Katziff, K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in-and-out music, which you're tapping your foot to right now. So thanks to all of you guys for being here.
Thank you.
And thanks to all of you for listening, and we will see you back here next week.